you took a patient with a brain injury who has to go in for, again, a serious procedure, a test, mm-hmm. that if they can go in putting themselves in a place that's very safe, comfortable, secure, then go in and do whatever has to be done, you're just in a whole different place of empowerment.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 13 of the Adventures in Brain Injury podcast. On this episode, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Lynn Hellerstein about her book, See It, Say It, Do It, her work in the field of vision therapy, and her method of using visualization to find success in the things we do in life and in the healing process. My name is Alec Hess, and with me is severe traumatic brain injury survivor and founder of AdventuresInBrainInjury.com, Kevin Ballister. So how's it going, Kevin?
Well, hello there, Alec. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. What's new with you?
Good. What's new with me? Well, actually, it's really hard to believe, but on Sunday, this Mother's Day, it will be the 5-year anniversary of my brain injury.
Right.
And it's really, it's an odd experience. You know, it always is. Every year, it's like, okay, you survived another year, I guess. And for some people, it evokes a whole lot of anxiety, and it invokes very painful memories. And for others, it's almost a cause for celebration because they've made it as far as they have. And I choose to go with the celebration route. I certainly think it's an event worth celebrating, and it's also worth reflecting on. And so for the past, I don't know, 4 years, I've been reflecting every year on my experience the year before. Let's see, the first year on my anniversary, I wrote the first post of my blog.
Right.
And then wrote, you know, just about every week after that, and did that for a year, documenting my story prior, you know, for the year prior. So basically on the anniversary of every important event, I would write about what happened a year ago on that anniversary date.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first anniversary. My second anniversary was with my family. You know, my mom flew out to New York within hours after I fell and was by my side and stuck with me for months, and then brought me back to her home in Texas,
mm-hmm.
where I received therapies, and she walked me through everything. And so, by the way, 5 years ago, May 8th, the day I fell, was also Mother's Day.
Right.
So she got the call at 4:30 in the morning on Mother's Day.
On Mother's Day, yeah.
And I say my mom gets 2 Mother's Days from now on.
Yeah.
Because Mother's Day and May 8th.
Right.
But today, it's the same. So she only gets 1 this year.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a really good one.
Yeah.
That's how that's going to go.
I'm hoping that we can do a full episode together and just discuss all the things that you've learned over the last 5 years, and you know, the hard truths and the valuable lessons, and talk about some of the people that you've come in contact with, some of the work that you've done, some of the speeches you've given, and really just do a reflection on the whole journey. And I think that'd be really valuable. So I'm glad that we're talking about it now, because it really gets me excited for having that conversation. You know, like you're saying, I know that anniversaries are a different thing for different survivors, but, I think there's just so much value in everything that you have to say about it all. So I'm excited to do that.
I think that would be very valuable for me as well. Just going over things, because, you know, there's so many things flying by. It's hard to remember what you've been through. And this is This goes beyond brain injury survivors. It's just people in general. Mm-hmm. You know, we all need to take a moment and reflect on the things we have done, what we have accomplished, what we have challenges we've had, and what we've learned from our experience. And I think it's really important to build on and to internalize experiences and lessons by going back and reflecting on those. And I find it super helpful. So I'd love to do that.
Great. Well, you know, we're also going to be talking today about success and reflection and all those things with our guest, Dr. Lynn Hellerstein. But before we do that, I want to just mention a couple of things. The first is we are now available on Google Play. So if you want to listen to this show through Google Play, you can just go to play.google.com/music and then do a search for Adventures in Brain Injury, or you can find it linked on the sidebar of the website at adventuresinbraininjury.com. And I wanted to just mention real quick, too, we got another review on iTunes, which I really loved. They said, great podcast. As a professional working with brain injury survivors, I love listening to these guys. I love how proactive Kevin is and how knowledgeable he has become on TBI. Truly an inspiration for anyone in this field. And I just want to welcome any of you who appreciate this show or if you find value in the show to give us a review on iTunes. That helps the show get more notice and helps it get out to the people who need it. But on that comment specifically, you know, I think that this is really a show that we try to make available to as many people as possible, whether they be survivors or caretakers or practitioners or just people who want a deeper sense of health and healing and wellness. You know, it really just makes me, and I know it does for you too, makes me really feel just grateful and like the work we do is meaningful when practitioners are listening. And I feel a lot of times like that's where change happens, you know?
Absolutely. You know, I first of all really appreciate that comment. I love it when practitioners listen to this and talk to me about it, and we create a dialogue on this, because my goal is to help to improve the current model in neurorehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that is with practitioners.
Right.
The word doctor, for example, comes from the Latin word doctor, which means to teach. And I like to encourage practitioners to teach their patients.
Right.
You know, therapists do teach. That's what they do. Therapists are like coaches. They teach you how to teach yourself, basically.
Right. That's right.
And that means so much. And what doctors can do is a lot of that as well. And we're actually going to be talking to an OD today who implements a lot of practices of mindfulness and awareness and even breathing techniques that are super useful in helping people to deal with their anxiety, to come into their acceptance, and to visualize a better outcome for themselves.
Absolutely.
And others.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I'm excited to get into this interview. I'm excited to talk about Dr. Hellerstein because you've known her for a while, and I just loved talking with her. She, you know, this episode.
She's so cool.
Oh, she's so cool. And we talked about, I mean, really, this was such a valuable interview. We talked about psychology. We talked about, you know, methods of success and healing through visualization, declaration. We talked about neurology, vision therapy. I mean, this really covered a lot of subjects, and she is such a phenomenal teacher. You can just hear it in the way that she describes her method, the see it, say it, do it method, why she wrote her book, how that affected children and adults, how she brings that to TBI patients, to patients in general, and how she finds, you know, how she gets people to find success, self-confidence, and push through, you know, the difficult tasks we all have.
Well,
great.
Without further ado, let's jump into it.
Okay, sounds good. So on the show with us today is Dr. Lynn Hellerstein, a fellow of the American Academy of Optometry and fellow and past president of the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, COVD. She's also the founder of Hellerstein and Brenner Vision Center, a full-scope optometric practice located in the Denver metro area of Colorado, which is dedicated to providing the highest quality vision care for patients of all ages. Hellerstein and Brenner Vision Center is concerned with prevention, treatment, remediation, and enhancement of the visual system for children and adults to achieve optimal function. With a highly trained staff and state-of-the-art equipment, her practice strives to go beyond 20/20. Dr. Hellerstein graduated with honors from Pacific University College of Optometry in 1977. She serves as an adjunct professor at the Illinois College of Optometry, University of Houston College of Optometry, and Southern College of Optometry. Among other things, she's the author of See It, Say It, Do It, The Parents and Teachers Action Guide to Creating Successful Students and Confident Kids, 50 Tips to Improve Your Sports Performance, and the See It, Say It, Do It, Organize It workbook. And she has a fantastic website. That's lynnhellerstein.com, LynnHellerstein.com. And we're excited to have her on today to talk about brain injury, neurology, vision therapy, visualization, and a whole mess of things. So thanks so much, Lynn, for being on with us today.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you on, Lynn. We've been trying to make this happen for a little time now, and we finally got it going on.
That's great.
Yeah, I was actually in Colorado over the holidays and got to stop by your practice, and it's gorgeous. It's state-of-the-art and very comprehensive, and I appreciate everything you're doing.
Well, thanks very much. It was great to see you over the holidays too, Kevin.
Well, this is really an exciting interview for me too, because you know, you have all these analogies for visualization and for how we move through challenges and how we think about things and how we find success, which really apply to all kinds of scenarios, you know, brain injury, just whatever the task is that we have in our lives. So I'm so excited that you're here, and I want to talk about all this stuff. I don't know. Let's get into it, Kevin. You start us off.
All right. So, first of all, your name is followed by a lot of letters after it. You got O-D, F-C-O-V-D, F-A-A-O. And most people don't know what those letters mean. They just know you worked really hard for them. So OD, what's OD?
So OD is the degree Doctor of Optometry. It's awarded after 4 years of optometry school, which is postgraduate after our bachelor's degree.
Perfect. And then FCOVD?
FCOVD is a fellowship from the College of Optometrists in Vision Development. And those letters are awarded after doing some rigorous studying, answering a number of open book questions, writing up 3 cases, doing a written test, and then having a follow-up oral test at COVD, College of Optometrists in Vision Development. And that's the group that certifies optometrists and vision therapists in vision therapy and development.
Yes. And I want to talk a bit about how development and rehabilitation are very related.
Yes.
Okay. So FAAO.
So that's a fellowship in the American Academy of Optometry, which is optometry's real science-based organization. A lot of research publishing is done through that group. Many academic folks go for their fellowship. And that, again, is it takes rigorous study, case reports, oral interview, and then that's where we're awarded the fellowship in the Academy of Optometry. And if you notice, a lot of physicians of all different types will actually have F, you know, a physician who's specialist in neurology will be a fellow in their neurologic association, or a physician who is a GI doc will be a fellow in that specialty. So it's additional study beyond the doctoral degree in certain kinds of special areas.
Great, thank you for that. So you're an optometrist, And there's a lot of confusion about ophthalmologists, optometrists, opticians. And I just kind of wanted to clear up what the difference is between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist.
Sure. A lot of people get all the O's confused. orthopedists, obstetricians. You know, we don't fix broken bones. We don't do pap smears. But we're in the eye care field. And I'll just give you a brief overview of the three big O's. The ophthalmologist is an MD medical doctor who's gone to undergraduate school, then 4 years of medical school, and then usually 3 to 4 years of ophthalmology residency. And their main emphasis is on eye disease, surgical repair, treatment with lots of medications and drugs. They're often at the top of the food chain for serious eye injuries, but most ophthalmologists in general practice have optometrists, ODs, doing the primary vision care, examining people's eyes for glasses, contact lenses. Optometrist is an OD 4-year postgraduate degree, like we mentioned before. And if in most medical systems, optometrists provide the primary eye care. That's true in the military services, in programs like Medicaid. Optometrists not only prescribe glasses, contact lenses, we have the ability to treat certain eye diseases like glaucoma or pink eye, things like that. Some optometrists actually can do some minor laser surgery. It depends on the state laws. And then under optometry is where vision rehabilitation and vision therapy really is provided. And we'll talk a lot more about that in this interview.
Right.
And then I was just going to mention an optician is a person who can sell glasses, can make glasses, fabricate glasses. Some are very highly trained and are certified. And some could just be a high school kid who's picked up a summer job. So it depends on the state, depends on the laws, but opticians can be very well trained to fabricate and sell glasses, but they do not prescribe glasses.
Gotcha. So my main focus is going to be in optometry because it sounds to me like ophthalmologists are medical doctors. They focus on the anatomy and function of the eye. Whereas it sounds to me like optometrists focus on the whole visual system. I've been told you look with your eye, but you see with your brain. And as a brain injury survivor, I'm interested in seeing with my brain.
Right. That's a good way to really view it. And the real difference that I see is ophthalmology deal a lot more in the structure and disease and physical attributes, things like that. And optometrists certainly evaluate and treat some of that, but we're much more interested in the functional aspects. How well can we coordinate the eyes? Can we improve our vision, our tracking, our focusing, convergence? And those are functional aspects that often other eye doctors don't really get involved in. It's similar to like a neurologist. It's really important in the diagnostic evaluation of serious kinds of illnesses and diseases. But it's really the therapy, physical therapists and physiatrists and other docs that do the functional aspect of rehabilitation and recovery. And that's really what we do in optometry is a lot more the functional aspects. Mm.
You know, I had a, I don't know if you know any of my story, but I suffered a severe retinal tear a few years back and had to go through the whole process of, removing the interior of the eye and just, the whole deal to get my retina to heal. And that would have been a retinopathist and an ophthalmologist. Is that correct?
Retinologist. That's retinologist. Correct. It's an ophthalmologist that specializes in retina.
I see. Okay. Right. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So when we're looking at eyeball problems like Alec has with the retina, we're looking at an ophthalmologist. But what we're talking about a lot in this interview is going to be visualization and picturing something in the mind's eye and feeling senses in our imagination, essentially. So let's talk about that. What's the difference between visual processing and visualization?
So visual processing is pretty much the overall sensory motor processing of visual information, meaning taking information that we see and then understanding what it means. So for example, if you gave me a chart in Russian and asked me to read a visual acuity chart in Russian, you would say, I'm blind because I can't read Russian. Now I can see the letters, but if I don't know what it means, if I can't put meaning to what I see, that's the visual processing aspect. Understanding what we see, understanding where things are in space, integrating that visual information with our other senses, you know, the eye-hand coordination, visual memory, visualization. So I refer to visual processing as the entire process of utilizing visual information from start to finish. Now, visualization is a piece of that I would refer to as internal vision.
Mm.
Creating pictures and senses in your, people often refer to your mind's eye, but I look at visualization much more than just pictures and seeing. It's really multisensory. You can have auditory imagery, visual mm-hmm. imagery, touch imagery, sound imagery. I'm using the word as visualization as kind of the whole package, the entire imagery package.
There's something that you said in one of your talks, and also I think in your book, and which I absolutely loved, which is when a child tells you that reading is boring, they're not wrong, because they're seeing the print on the paper, and that is not very interesting. But when they've found the ability to visualize is when they learn to love reading, because they're not reading the print on the page anymore. It's the scene happening in their head, right? And you have these great examples of Harry Potter scenes that kids can relate to and adults can relate to. And so I loved that example. That really spoke to me.
Well, that really touches most parents, because great readers talk about the movies going on in their head.
Mm-hmm.
They see the pictures, the movie, the action. They would, they would much rather read the book than see the movie.
Right.
And kids who hate to read, and adults, think they're crazy. Why would you ever want to read the book? I want to see the movie. And usually what's happening is they're not getting that translation of the written language, those words, into imagery and picture. And that's where the meaning and the fun takes place, is when you really get the story in imagery.
Right. And from the other perspective of that, which is another great example you gave, was the skier at the start of the race line. You see them close their eyes, you see them kind of sway back and forth, and they're doing it in their mind, right? They're visualizing the whole course as they prepare to go down it, and you can see their body moving. And I mean, you can just visualize this now as I describe it, right? They're visualizing the whole course and prepping and seeing themselves find success and go down. So I love that example too. And I love how that applies to sports, but all these different mediums, all these different, venues in our lives. So very, very cool.
Well, that's so true. Sports vision is a big area of interest, and many, many athletes are spending thousands and thousands of dollars to improve their visualization skills,
mm-hmm.
because there's actually studies that show that when you mentally practice, that's imagery, seeing and feeling the movements in your head, it's actually triggering the same brain cells as if you went through the activity for real.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's additional practice time, and it's powerful. The thing is, it's very powerful, be it positive or negative. So if you're like a gymnast and you keep picturing yourself falling off the beam, and you keep picturing and practicing that over and over and over, that becomes a brain pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think's going to happen when you get on that beam?
Right.
Bam, you're off.
You're already firing.
That's right. And so imagery and visualization is very, very powerful. But the whole goal is to empower folks to use their visualization in a way that it's really helpful and successful for them.
Right. And, you know, to tie into rehabilitation, too, Cavan wrote an article on his blog at adventuresinbrainjury.com called How Reading Changes the Brain, which focused on a 19-day brain connectivity study, basically demonstrating that engaging in imaginative activities, reading stories, etc., visualization, triggers brain activity associated with those bodily sensations, like you're saying. So just simply thinking about running triggers the firing of those neurons. And I just want to quote the sort of summation he had at the end of that. In short, reading stories triggers brain activities associated with bodily sensations, a powerful statement in the context of brain injury. When caretakers are working to encourage the regeneration of neurons in damaged areas of the brain associated with things like language, movement, and memory. Moreover, if brain connectivity is heightened during other imaginative activities, which seems plausible, then merely reading stories to brain injury patients or walking them through meaningful memories and visualization could have equal benefit. And of course, the short study has us wanting more, but that's a really hopeful and interesting thing to think about, you know, is that how can we help people using visualization, not just in the, you know, preemptive sort of preparing for the game and preparing for that stuff, but also in the rehabilitative side, right? Also in kind of bringing that stuff back and refiring those things. So I found that article really fascinating and really ties in here.
That's very insightful, Cavan. And, you know, we've had patients where we brain injury patients that we've done a lot of visualization work, and they'll go back, you know, like a year later to the neuropsychologist for post-testing. And we've had a number of patients tell us that the neuropsych is so surprised how much better their visual memory is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they'll actually ask them, you know, what did you do? How's this better? And we've worked a lot on visualization, how to create and store, you know, visual memories.
Well, what you're saying with the negative and positive visualization, visualizing something that is not desirable happening versus visualizing something you want to happen happening, and how neuroplasticity plays into that. And if we're firing the same neurons by thinking about something, we are reinforcing those pathways. And I think it's right on how when it's imagining something undesirable, that reinforces those patterns. Whereas when we imagine what it is we want to happen, it reinforces those patterns.
Right.
And I'm curious as to how you train somebody's ability to visualize or rehabilitate their ability to visualize.
Sure. And you know, a lot of this is based on the neuroplasticity and neurology kinds of principles. There's an old saying in neurology, it's practice makes permanence, not perfect, but permanence. Hmm. Meaning when you practice an activity, whether it's in your mind or you're really practicing, that's the triggering of those neurons that you've been talking about. And we know to create a new habit, it takes practice.
You know, I haven't heard that, but my karate teacher used to say, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect.
That's interesting.
And that's kind of the same thing you're saying. It does. It's practice reinforces whatever it is you're practicing. And that's where negative plasticity comes in. When we reinforce bad patterns.
That's correct.
Maybe bad patterns isn't the word. I don't know. Unfavorable patterns.
Yeah, but inappropriate or inaccurate. I mean, that's where neurology, the brain cells fire the way we practice. If we practice in a way that's not helpful or it's negative, we even know thoughts. Same thing if we keep thinking the same bad thoughts. You know, neurology says practice makes permanence. that pathway becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. Mm-hmm. So to change a pathway, you need to practice differently. So the question is, so how do you get started in improving your visualization? And there's three steps that I really try to teach. You know, I believe everybody can visualize to different levels. Some people know that they're great visualizers. I mean, they see pictures in, you know, 3D and huge colors, and they describe imagery unbelievably in great detail. Then there's some people that don't think they visualize at all, but they kind of have a sense, an awareness, a gut feeling. You know, so that's why when I describe visualization, I use multi-sensory approach, because if I just always say, you need to see it, you need to see it, then I have just gotten rid of a large group of people who now think they can't visualize. And that's incorrect, because they're doing imagery in some other sensory system. Hmm. So I have to totally respect that people really use different systems to image. And you can tell from their language often what they're doing. For example, I might say, see you later. Well, I'm probably more of a visual kind of a processor, as opposed to talk to you later. It's more of an auditory sense. Mm-hmm. Keep in touch, more of a kinesthetic. So if we start listening to language, we can really start understanding what the strength and learning style is of a person.
What about catch you later?
What do you think catch you later would be?
That's kinesthetic, I would
very
say.
Very kinesthetic, yep. Right. Yeah. Right. And this is very important information. I mean, salespeople study this a lot.
Right.
Because they want to know how you process, because if they can sell you through your dominant processing system, there's a much better chance you're going to buy their product. So salespeople for years have known the power of having communication through your, you know, main learning style. Mm-hmm. So let's get back to, so how do you get started? Well, the very first step that I'll use is relaxation. You know, if you've ever had anybody to do an imagery, a relaxation with you, they'll often talk to you about get comfortable, you know, kind of shake out the jitters, kind of move around and get settled in. Make sure your feet are supported on the floor and you're feeling very comfortable. So relaxation, whatever that means, is the first step to starting this process. And some people will find it, they can sit down and do it. Some people lay down and there's, the rules of visualization is, there's not really any rules, except that I'm very respectful of wherever you're at. So there's not right or wrong ways of doing this. Okay?
Gotcha.
So we start with the relaxation, and then we move into breathing. And the breathing, you know, I'm sure you've had a lot of people tell you when you're tense or upset, breathe.
Right.
And you go, you know, you hold your breath, your shoulders go up, you're breathing into your chest, and it actually stops you from breathing.
Right, right.
So we need to learn to breathe. And I am amazed at the number of young kiddos I see in my practice that are diagnosed with anxiety problems, and adults, and nobody's worked on their breathing. Mm-hmm. And I find this critical to life, of course.
Right.
But we use breathing strategies anytime we have medical kinds of tests. You know, a lot of times we'll want to take the pressure in your eyes and people get pretty tensed up. And I'll just have them sit back, relax, take a breath with me. Boom, I can do that test in 2 seconds.
Mm. Wow.
And when I've been in the hospital for my own medical things and watching my family, if people would just help a patient relax, breathe, they'll have a much better success at doing the procedure.
Absolutely. Yeah. In my own experience, you know, of being in immense pain, just unbearable. Of course, breathing, you got to breathe through it. And I learned a box breathing because it's super easy to remember. You just breathe in for four, hold for four, breathe out for four, hold for four. And there's your box.
Yep, that's a great strategy.
There's all sorts of other ones, but yeah, it's really helpful. And oxygen to the brain, also extremely important. And so making sure we're staying oxygenated.
Totally.
Yeah.
Another simple but powerful breathing strategy, and I'll start with having you hold your hands on your belly. And breathe in your nose, and then you breathe out your nose once, and then breathe in your nose, and pretend like you're just blowing out a balloon. And as you continue that breathing in and breathing out, like you're blowing out birthday candles, you just notice your hands going up and down on your belly. And when you start seeing those hands go up and down on your belly, that's when your breathing often slows and relaxes. And it's very effective. Kids do that very well. And if they don't, we have them put, it's a little outdated, but if you can find a phone book or a big book to put on your belly, just put it on your belly and just try and make the book go up and down with your breath. And it's amazing how things will calm down when you start breathing into your belly. And Kevin, okay. I appreciated your comment about pain, because what I'll sometimes do is have the patient put their hand right where the pain is. If it's in your head, if it's in your leg, wherever it is, I have the patient put their hand right on the pain and tell them just breathe into their hand. Breathe into their hand and focus on the hand. Breathe in and out and bring the attention to right where that pain is.
Perfect.
And it's a way to really try. You know, the more we try to push away the pain, the more the pain keeps coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can, you know, acknowledge there's the pain, let's relax. And it's hard to relax, but just bring oxygen right to that area.
I just had a thought about yoga. Every time I've gone to yoga, we do quite a bit of visualization and breathing into certain areas and really visualizing things within our bodies. And it's like visualizing healing in our bodies, visualizing all sorts of things. Really, really, I don't know, it feels great.
And Kevin, yoga has been a very big part of my healing. And a lot of what I've brought into my practice has come from yoga, you know, added to what I've learned in optometry. I mean, we learned about visualization, but what yoga and some of the other things I've personally experienced has done is really taken visualization into the body, not just the mind's eye. And breathing is a very big part of that. And there is actually getting to be some good evidence to show the power in healing and improving body function by doing that. And so, you're right on. I totally agree with your analogies on that.
No, so, you're right on. All right. So now I am very, very relaxed.
I'm pretty relaxed myself. Thank you, guys.
So what's the next step?
So step one was relax. Step two is breathing. Step three is building awareness. So what does that mean? Well, in visualization, it's all about the awareness. And I might say awareness without judgment is critical. In other words, you might see something and imagine something. Like, let's say you're ready to perform a sport and you see yourself looking really bad. Now, the judgment is bad. Okay, if we can let go of that judgment and just be aware, wow, I see myself. I'm looking small. My hair's all messed up. I'm not wearing very nice clothes, am I? That's all awareness. Because once we're aware of what we're noticing, we can make changes. All right, that does it. I'm going to wear my best tennis outfit. And I'm going to stand up tall. In fact, I'm going to kind of blow myself a little bigger. Really make myself really look large. And man, there comes a smile. I've got my sunglasses. I've got... And so when you build the awareness, you just notice what's there without judgment.
Right.
Because it's the judgment that stops us from moving forward.
And it also prevents us from actually visualizing what's happening or what it is, you know, instead of describing what it is, you know, it's labeling.
That's exactly right. It's all about the judgment. Then you get in your head and you get into this whole bah, 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 you know, talk about self. And the whole goal of imagery and visualization is to really just be an observer. What do you notice? How does that feel? How big is it? I'll give you an example how we can use that. Let's say you're trying to apply for a job here and you've been out of work for years and this is a big opportunity. And if you don't get this job, man, you have no money. And so if I ask a person, so imagine what that's like. What do you notice? And that's what they'll often say. You know, they look small and they're not very happy and it's dark and we'll play with the pictures. So what would you like to do to make your picture look stronger? And they come up with the ideas. I don't. You know, it's not for me to tell them how to change their pictures. It's for me to inquire. So, gee, you look small. Is that how you want to go into your interview? No. Well, what would you like to do about that? Well, I'm going to make myself bigger. Well, how would you like to do it? Well, maybe wear high heels, maybe blow yourself up, maybe stretch out. I mean, you could do anything you want. And when you start hearing a patient start making funny jokes and silly things, you know they're in their imagery and they're shifting things.
Hmm.
And that's huge. I'll give you another example. A little kid who has to read in front of the class. Reading in front of a class for a kiddo who's a poor reader is devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And they cry about it at home, and they sometimes don't even want to go to school because it's so awful emotionally. So I had a little kiddo that came in for an exam, and she was about 7, and I said, how's school? She said, oh, fine. And I said, so tell me about your reading. And she just burst into tears. And I, whoa. Mm-hmm. So when she's in an emotional state, and we know this from neurology, there is no thinking, useful thinking that's going to take place when you're in an emotional state. So trying to ask her questions and answers about her book, I mean, you're wasting your time. She's in emotions. There's no useful thought process going on there. She's
dominated by the amygdala, mostly.
That's exactly the case, right. So the question is, so how are we going to move out of the amygdala? So I said, whoa, let's stop for a minute. Let's kind of take a break. And you know what? Would you like to play a little game and just imagine where would you like, anywhere you could go, where would you like to go right now? And she started, you know, calming down. She says, I want to go swimming. I said, okay, let's pretend we're swimming. So right away she stops crying. You know, she jumps in the pool and I said, could I jump in too? So I'm with her and we're splashing. We're having a great time. And then I go, hey, look what I found. And I said, here, catch this. And I pretend like I throw her something. And she goes, what is that? And I said, oh, it's a magic book. Look, dunk it in the water. And she dunks it. She goes, oh, my gosh, it's a book. And it doesn't get ruined in the water. I said, I told you it's magic. She said, can I look at it and see what it says? And I said, well, sure.
Hmm.
So here she's ready to read.
Right.
Okay. So her job... And we practiced this, and she'd have fun. So her job was, the next day when she went to school, was not to even pick up her book until she takes a swim in her mind. And then she can do her schoolwork from the pool, and nobody needs to know, and nobody cares.
Wow.
Except her. And that's how you can empower patients you know, I've given you more in learning related. If you took a patient with a brain injury who has to go in for, again, a serious procedure, a test, that if they can go in putting themselves in a place that's very safe, safe is big, very safe, comfortable, secure, then go in and do whatever has to be done. You're just in a whole different place of empowerment.
Right. This is very related too to just even my own experience with my retinopathist, just because, you know, every time I go in to double check the progress of my healing or the safety and security of my other eye, we do this just very intense and sort of invasive, you know, testing with just full dilation in the lights and, you know, pushing all over the eyeball. And it's just very, very bright and it's just making me tear. And so I go into these breathing techniques that you describe. You know, I just breathe through it. I imagine myself in a different place and I'm just kind of there enough to work with her and get everything tested. And she's very good about it, but it's still just a really intense experience. So visualization helps me, even though I'm not a brain injury survivor myself, just even through that realm, it just helps me tremendously. And it's very much in line with everything I've learned in my psychology of mindfulness courses too, about breathing, strengthening the OMPFC, about getting away from the amygdala. So I'm really loving it. And I'd like to ask you about your own application.
Al, before you go, can you tell me what the OMPFC is?
It's the orbital medial prefrontal cortex. Yeah. It's more of your kind of high functioning center. You know, it's moving your brain away from the amygdala into more of the high functioning emotional regulation and things like that center. So that's sort of what we talk about in that course as being beneficial from relaxation and mindfulness and breathing and visualization and things like that. But anyway, I digress. I want to ask you, Lynn, more about your own application of See It, Say It, Do It, where that book came from. And if you could talk about how you applied that to running a marathon. I thought that story was amazing. And I think it's a really relatable story to anybody who's got to go through their own marathon, be it rehabilitation like Kevin has gone through, or other brain injury patients have gone through, or even the stuff I've gone through with my own vision. Do you mind talking about that?
Surely. My pleasure. Well, again, I was, I've been in vision therapy and vision rehabilitation for more than 35 years. And saw the power of what we do in vision therapy, where we can improve tracking and focusing and depth perception, eye-hand coordination, visual processing, visualization. And so, you know, I loved the field. It was, everything was great until 2002. I ended up with a serious medical condition myself. Ended up with several surgeries, affected my digestive system, my colon. And it just totally threw me for a loop. You know, they talk about the gut being the second brain, which that's a whole nother topic.
But
when I had a foot of my colon taken out, I remember going to my colon surgery and saying, did you operate on my brain? Because I can't think well. I can't drive. It's too much chaos. I can't even watch TV and understand what I'm saying.
Wow.
And the doctor looked at me like I was going crazy. And that's exactly how I felt, like I was going crazy. And it was just a colon kind of surgery. And through that, I became allergic to all foods. I couldn't digest foods. And I went through this whole thing that I really couldn't digest life. I mean, I totally lost myself. All the great accolades in the books and optometry and my mother and wife, all these kinds of labels that I had no longer were meaningful. I was trying to figure out who I was and what is truly my purpose in life here. And so through this place of being lost, I ended up finding a psychologist. And, you know, when we're open to the universe, a lot of funny things can happen that we don't even know to look for. But I found I was part of a study using meditation for chronic illness, because I also had irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, and that was the chronic illness they were using meditation for. And so because I couldn't eat and I couldn't digest well, I thought, well, might as well try this. And I found it very, very helpful in symptom reduction. And when we were done with the study, it was a PhD study for a person getting her degree, I said, this is so similar to my type of work in visualization, but it's just a lot more body related. I wanted to study more with the person who created the meditations that we were using in the study. So I decided to look for her, and I Googled her to see where in the world she's from, because we only had her CDs. And of course, she ended up being one of our patients, and my daughter was teaching her daughter dance
class. No way.
Yeah, one of those kind of, really?
What?
So, yeah, so, and she lives down the block from my office. So right. So, all of those kinds of
serendipitous.
Things. That's right. The stars were aligned, yep. Kind of thing. Yep, so yep. I did in-depth study, took her coursework, intensive coursework, and became certified in this process that was so similar to what we do in visualization, but at a much deeper level within the body. And so that was really... So here I am finding much of my own work at a deeper level, healing my medical condition. And I found that so empowering, and it got me, back onto my life as to what I wanted to do. And really what came up for me is I want to do the same work, but at a much bigger level. Instead of one-on-one treatment of patients, I want to take it out to the world, to millions and millions of patients. So that's, how 2002 for a few years was for me. And I was asked at COVD to give a lecture on visualization. I gave a whole day lecture. And when I was done, I thought, man, this was really some great stuff. But, it's from a lot of different wonderful people. I mean, it's not my own creation. Dr. Elliot Forrest and a lot of psychologists. There's been a lot of people that have contributed to my knowledge base. But the way I put it together was unique. And I thought someday somebody needs to write about this. Too bad it's not going to be me, because I hate to write. I hate to write. Well, within 3 months, I took a personal development course that ended up making me realize I had a book in my head and I had to get it out somehow. And that's how I started creating the book, See It, Say It, Do It. Because again, the power of visualization is huge. But that by itself doesn't always change our lives. There seem to be a couple other steps that were needed to make big changes in our lives. And those other steps were declaration and taking action. So see it, say it, do it is visualize, declare, take action. And from all that process, you get transformation. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same process big businesses use. When they have a vision of creating a new building or a new business plan, they make a declaration, a mission statement, and then they have action plans. Mm-hmm. And there's studies in business that show if you don't have those components really in place, there's a very, very high chance you won't be successful at your imagery, at your picture. And so I was beginning to experiment with myself and others to find out that we all do parts of those three things. They don't have to be in that order. But if we don't do all of them, often something gets lost or something's not completed. So, for example, there's a lot of people that visualize just great things. I'm going to be someday. Oh, they have these great images and nothing changes in their life. They never take action. I call those dreamers. Okay. There are some people that all they do is run around like their head's cut off, just busy, 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 in the same job. They never go anywhere further. And I call those busy workers. But the people that you see that really just keep moving in their life and transforming and building seem to go through this see it, say it, do it process. And that's where the say it and do it really came to add on to the see it, which is something I'd been doing and teaching for years. And so the way I started my book was, again, you got to remember, I was saying, I hate to write. I hate writing. I hate writing. Well, I wasn't
reinforcing that.
I wasn't doing very well in my writing until I said, I need to find a book coach, found a book coach who was recommended to me, who happened to be, unbeknownst at the time, one of my patients from years ago who had a brain injury and had been through vision therapy.
Wow.
Okay, again, another
Small world. Serendipitous.
Right. So she helped get me, you know, going and writing on my book. So we got to, you know, every night I would go over after work, and we'd write and rewrite and write. I got to chapter 4, Say It. And I didn't have a story for that. I was trying to think, what story? And sure enough, you know, here we are. It's February of 2009. I don't have a story on it. And my daughter, who lives in Seattle, happened to ask me to walk a marathon with her. Now, I love my kids. And anytime I can do something and be with my kids, I take full advantage of that. And they're adults with kids now. And I still, anytime we can do something together, I want to do it. So she says, Mom, will you walk a marathon? I said, oh, yeah, sure. Okay. So I said it. And then I went home and stewed about it.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Walk it. You got to be kidding. You know, so the first thing I did was Googled it. And I got some great pictures. You know, you always see pictures crossing the people crossing the finish line with their hand and fist up. And they're always smiling. So that was my picture. So I see it. And then I created a whole to-do list. I need to walk so many miles a day. I need to get new orthotics. I need to do this. I need to do that. And I started, and it was, you know, February. And, Kevin, you know what it's like, February in Colorado. It can be cold and icy and snowy for a lot.
Mm-hmm. So same with Alec. He lives out there right now. Yep. You guys aren't too far.
Yep.
That's right. And so my walking, you know, if I went 2 miles on the treadmill and I couldn't stand the treadmill, it was a lot. And again, I was not doing very well in my training. It's like, if I can't walk more than 1 or 2 miles a couple of days a week, this is not great training for a marathon that's 26.2 miles.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, I started, you know, I remember taking a walk. I hate riding. I'm not going to be able to do this marathon. I can't do this. My feet are going to kill me. My digestive system's going to act up. There is no way. And then I stop cold and I go, if I believe in this process, see it, say it, do it. Listen to the words that I'm speaking. I can't do this. I'll never do this. I hate this. And I realized that, oh my gosh, no wonder things aren't moving along. I'm not following my own advice here.
Mm-hmm.
So I was walking. I said, fine, I'm a marathoner. Yeah, did that inspire you? That's how it inspired me. Not really. So I'm walking. I'm a marathon. You know, that this is not working. I'm not a marathoner. I don't even know how to do a marathon. I've never walked a marathon. And then it just hit me. I go, I am a marathoner.
Right. I'm
going to
do this.
Up, it's a marathon of life.
Hmm. There you go.
You know, I made it through all my digestive and my surgeries. I made it through my recovery. I'm back in my life. This has been a marathon, and I'm still running my marathon. I am a marathoner.
Mm-hmm. That's what the declaration thing is to me mostly is confidence, is building that confidence.
Right. And you have to say it like it's already happened, but you have to be able to believe in it. So for me to say I'm a marathoner, you can hear I don't believe in it. That won't build any confidence. Mm-hmm. But when I really saw I really am a marathoner, I reframed how I see what a marathon is. I believed it. It is true. I could live by that. And it was after that time that all my training changed. And, you know, the end of the story is we made it through our 26.2 miles in 7.5 hours. And even now, looking back, I don't know how I did it.
Yeah.
But I remember the step by step, the declaration. So for me, the piece that I'll sometimes leave out is a say it piece. And until I can get that clear and believe in it, it's all about believing in what you're saying. So you have to come up with a declaration that's meaningful to you. It didn't have to be, I'm a marathoner. It could be, I'm great. I can do, it can be anything, but it's an I am kind of a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what really turned the tide for me on the marathon. And that became the story in chapter 4 about the power of say it. And so we use this kind of strategy, whether it's a little kid. I mean, my little five-year-old grandkids, you know, sometimes run around the house, see it, say it, do it, ta-da! You know, and we play a whole game of it. All the way to adults, to big business. I have business coaches asking if they can use the strategies with adults. And of course, what's unique about See It, Say It, Do It is that I've taken this kind of material that a lot of business coaches do well, but really made it so that it's very usable for kids. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine if we started giving our kids this kind of empowerment at a young age.
Right.
You know, how that might impact their lives forever.
Totally.
This is actually what I wanted to talk to you about, is how development and developmental optometry and development in general is so closely related to rehabilitation, because we're rewiring, we're redeveloping the brain after an injury.
What I love about what you're saying, Kevin, too, and this whole piece and the marathon story is, you also say that we all have our marathons, right? And sometimes those marathons choose us. And clearly, Kevin, you have run a marathon, right? And I have to believe that you did a lot of this process throughout your own rehabilitation, that you visualized yourself as a brain injury survivor, right? And getting back up and walking again and playing and singing again, right? And mm-hmm. saying, I am a musician and I'm going to pick up this guitar and I'm going to do these things, and making those declarations that you did to get back to all these different aspects of function, right?
You got it, Al. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, this model has been used by me a lot subconsciously or unconsciously, and I don't always use it, of course. Like, there are times where I don't make that happen, and where I bet you don't always make it happen, you know. But it's an excellent model for living out your dreams and making things happen.
You know, Kevin, I totally agree, and your story gives me chills. I mean, because you have used this a lot. And you're right, I don't always use this model. It's when I'm stuck and I forget.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I spent a lot of money on a coach, business coach, and he looked at me and he says, this is why I paid him the big bucks. He says, well, I have 6 words that I think will be very helpful for you. And I'm on the edge of my seat, ready for these insightful, inspirational words.
I already know what they are.
See it, say it, do it. And I go, you got to be kidding me. And it's like, I totally forgot. You know? And that's why we need coaching and, you know, renewal, because we all fall out of these patterns.
Right.
Well, the more we practice, just doing this interview, and I got to tell you guys, has gotten me so passionate, engaged again. Mm-hmm. About this, because we slip into the busy work and the, you know, everyday, you know, blahs, and it's really about moving forward and whatever it takes to move forward. But I did want to address your great question, Kevin, about development and rehab. I'm really blessed that my career started out really doing pediatric optometry. You know, I learned about kids and development, and you know, how movement and vision were so integrated, and they affected each other, and we built that up. And I was all about kids and learning disabilities and eye-hand coordination and things like that, until one day one of my patients said, you know, Grandma just had a stroke, and she reads just like I do now. She skips words, and she doesn't remember what she's read, and can you help Grandma? And at that time, I knew, didn't really know anything about brain injury or stroke, and I knew about vision. I said, well, I don't know, let's have Grandma come in and try. And then I'd get, you know, my uncle was in a car accident and he had a head injury and he's got double vision, can you help him there? And that's really how I got into the field of working with patients with brain injury, with my strong background in developmental vision And my sister is an occupational therapist, so we did a lot of vision movement things, you know, with our kids. Mm-hmm. Bringing them to adults was so easy and was so effective that I'm really blessed that I had my background in developmental vision, because it just helped it seem so easy in understanding what a patient with a visual processing problem after brain injury would need. And so it is all about neuroplasticity, rebuilding the brain. There's no question that can be done at any age, but we know as a kid, you know, it's very accelerated and very fast. And but we still see it as adults. And anything we can do to help a patient transform like that, you know, that's what I want to be a part of.
That's great.
It's actually super interesting that it's easier with kids as far as neuroplasticity goes, and it's harder with adults. And the reason I believe that is because neuronal patterns have already been created. And now not only do we need to, like, if that's negative plasticity or it's reinforcing behavior that we don't want, we first need to sever those connections, and I don't mean physically, but we need to, you know, break those old patterns and reestablish new patterns. And it's the breaking of old patterns that's so difficult. That's the, you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Attitude.
Yeah, right. Attitude. Well, you can, but it is, like you said, it is going to be more difficult. Thing is, with brain injury, a lot of those connections have been severed. And yes. now we, and I forget the study, but there was a study showing that soon after an injury to the nervous system, plasticity is accelerated, much like it is when you're a child. And I thought that was super interesting.
That's interesting. And you're correct. You know, when there's been an injury, you've lost some of those connections. But what I find that's really different with these adults is they'll often know and grieve the loss, where a kid doesn't even know that. You know, they don't know they can't read well, or that they're clumsy. Whereas an adult had something that's been taken away. So there's a whole layer of grief and emotion.
That amygdala is going crazy.
Yep. Yeah.
And the awareness of what they've lost really is what you're describing.
The awareness.
Too.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to just add a couple of things real quick too, if you guys don't mind. I love Peggy Mason's previous guest we had, neurobiologist, who talked about how when you have a brain injury, it's like you have this highway of connectivity in your brain that gets shut down. And so what you have to do is remap it and re-navigate the side streets. And to me, that is just the perfect marathon analogy, you know, that's what recovery and rehabilitation is. It's realizing all of a sudden you've been given this new marathon to re-navigate and remap those side streets, which I really love. And the other two pieces I want to say, just from a psychological perspective, when you talk about coaching, and sometimes we need coaching and sometimes we forget this process, you know, what we say about therapy is really therapy is just borrowing somebody else's frontal lobes. And we all have to do that because we get caught up in our amygdala. We get caught up in the anxiety and the just organizing everything and having everything, you know, everything up on our shoulders. So I really love that piece too. I love just the acceptance of, yes, I'm in this mental state. Even though I should know this stuff, I need somebody else to come in and just let me borrow their frontal lobes for a little bit. And then they can help me get back into my own frontal lobes, you know? So don't give yourself a hard time if, you know, you've got to pay a coach to come back and say, hey, I've got six words for you, because, you know, that's, you're not in your frontal lobes at that point, and that's what they're there for. So
that's a great analogy, Alec. And that's the piece without judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we can leave that judgment piece off of it and go, you know, thanks, coach, versus, oh, man, I was stupid. Why couldn't I remember that? That's exactly what you're talking about. That's
right.
True.
And the last thing I want to say, too, from a psychology standpoint is just, you know, there's a way we look sometimes at emotion and experience and perception. We say we don't smile because we're happy. We're actually happy because we smile. And that to me, I think, is a big part of the declaration. You know, it's that the reality is that if we see, you know, if we're driving and we see the flashing lights of a police car in the back, we actually have physiological reactions to that before we see it and then have a reaction to it, right? We react to things and we physiologically smile. We have a neurological, psychological reaction that makes us smile. Then we realize we're smiling and that makes us happy. And there's a ton of science on this and a ton of practice out there encouraging people to smile more, and they report being happier, right? And so to me, I think that is where just the declaration piece is really well-founded and really well-rooted, is to say to yourself, and we can all relate to this. We can all relate to having a project or something that's a big deal and feel that moment where we go, you know what? Actually, I can do this, and I am this person, and I'm going to make this happen. And when we find that, it's like we believe in it, and it becomes easy, and we just find that path to success. So I love the process. I love to see it, say it, do it.
Both of you guys, your understanding and passion is what really inspires me.
Oh, man. It goes both ways. I love your story. I love everything you've done and how you're influencing lives from kids to adults to athletes to optimize to CEOs. You know, you name it, and using a simple model and incorporating relaxation, breathing, observing without judgment.
One of the things that I did want to add is, you know, a lot of people will listen to me and think I'm, what am I, a psychologist or a teacher or a coach, or not even understand why I would be coming from an optometrist. And my unique view in this whole perspective is that I'm looking at vision inside and out. I've had the great opportunity of really learning how people see and how they interpret the world and what we can do with glasses and lenses and prisms to change how the world looks to them and how they move through that world. But adding this internal vision component with that, that they can make changes internally that show up externally and vice versa, is what's very unique, and I think the real power of this type of work. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is from Wayne Dyer, who I thought was an optometrist, and he used to say, change the way you look at things, and the things you look at change. And I really thought he must be an eye doctor. That's what we do in vision therapy all the time.
Right.
And he's not. He's a psychologist, and it's about, you know, do we start internally? Do we start externally? It goes both ways.
Right.
And this is about vision inside and out.
I love that.
That's great.
The internal and the external vision.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lynn. It's really, really an honor to have you on the podcast.
Absolutely.
And we will, you know, next time I'm in Colorado, I will definitely hit you up, and I'd love to hang out again.
Yeah, we'll both take you out to dinner this time.
There you go.
That sounds great. And come in, we'll take you to a baseball game again.
Excellent.
All right. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, you guys are great. I wish you the best with all your podcasts, and I'll look forward to let me know when it's all completed, and we'll go from there.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you very
much,
guys.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
To learn more about Dr. Hellerstein, you can visit her website at lynnhellerstein.com. That's lynnhellerstein.com. And we'll have this episode and every episode uploaded to adventuresinbraininjury.com, where we'll list the show notes for this episode, including Lynn's different books, and we welcome you to come by and leave a comment. And we want to say a special thank you to our supporters. If you find value in this show or the work Kevin and I do, raising awareness through adventures and brain injury, we welcome you to come by our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/AIBI, or drop by the website adventuresandbraininjury.com/support, where we have many different options and ways to help us get this show out to more people, to raise awareness, and to do more episodes. That's going to be this episode, everybody. Thank you very much for tuning in, and a special thanks to Dr. Lynn Hellerstein. We'll see you next time. Take me.